for the day, for the week possibly. I'm very pleased to be taking part in this in this panel, which I think is long overdue. Having panels as Roman has organised at the PSA on emotion politics is a long overdue development in my view. What I'll do in this talk is to, following on from Nicholas really, is to present some, just one or two quite general ideas for thinking about the place of emotion in politics. And actually the ideas that I think I have to offer are very much within the first of the two traditions that Nicholas identified, that is the political sociology of emotions. And specifically within the kind of psychoanalytically influenced strand within that broader tradition. So I'll outline just a couple of broad concepts, as I say, coming from that tradition. And then what I'll discuss is a particular example taken, I'm afraid, not from Greek politics, but from British politics, concerning the far-right British National Party. I'm afraid that as it's turned out, and given the time constraints, I'm not going to get on to talking, as my abstract said I would, about the a particular appearance of that party on BBC television. But I will instead be taking a particular kind of area of BNP contemporary rhetoric and looking at the emotional dynamics associated with that. And it's often said that times of crisis are times of opportunity for extremist groups parties and movements. So I think that by looking closely at particular examples of the emotional dynamics underlying extremist politics at the moment, we may be able to throw a bit of light on the contemporary crisis in Greece and indeed the crisis elsewhere. Let me start with the idea of the emotional public sphere. And I use this term to refer to the constant emotional activity which is intrinsic to the public sphere as usually conceived. This is the emotional activity that's embedded in the debates, the deliberations and the procedures of the democratic process. And this activity may well be hidden, or certainly rather obscurely visible. It's often poorly understood, but it can have a decisive influence on the outcome of processes in the official life of politics. It can influence election results, policy-making outcomes, shifts in public opinion, and so forth. And I think the realisation of this world of emotion is one of the drivers behind the turn to affect that Nicholas commented on at the start, the quite widespread turn now amongst social scientists in various disciplines, and actually to understand the political process as a whole, one has to pay quite close attention to its kind of emotional underbelly. So, the emotional public sphere is, I would say, it's there as a constant accompaniment to the conventional public sphere. All politicians, whether they know it or not, are engaged in managing the emotions which populate the emotional public sphere. They are in the business of trying to identify those emotions, to understand and respond to whatever currents of feeling are seen to be out there, and indeed to influence those currents of feeling in ways that serve an interest, whether it's a partisan interest or a national interest, as understood by individuals, or some combination of both. But they are in the business of trying to influence public feeling. And I've suggested elsewhere the phrase emotional governance to refer to that work of emotional management. And if you look at the business of politics from the viewpoint of understanding the politics-emotions nexus, then emotional governance is mainly what politics is actually about. It's not only politicians who are involved in it. Journalists have got a major role to play in shaping the profile of feelings which define a national emotional public sphere. And so also do celebrities and other public figures. In fact, anyone who's on the national stage, however briefly, may contribute in a fleeting way to the tone of the emotional public sphere. Okay, so those are a couple of background general concepts that I offer to you as just ways of talking about, thinking about the role of emotional politics. When we're examining the emotional public sphere and the dynamics of emotional governance, we may find that things look quite different from how they look in the light of more familiar approaches to describing and analysing politics. studying the emotional forces at work in politics, compared with the conventional analysis of policies and strategies and so forth, I think is a bit like looking at the pictures from a thermal imaging camera compared to those from a normal light-sensitive one. In both cases, we're looking at the same body politic, and that body politic will have the same broad shape and the same movements, whatever instrument you're using to look at it. With a conventional light-sensitive camera, you get a sharp, detailed picture of what's on the surface of the body. With a heat camera, you get a blurry picture, but one which shows an interior that is not visible to the conventional camera, an interior with distributions of energy and fields of activity not apparent to the ordinary camera. Well, let me try and take this this broad approach to the example I mentioned from British politics, which will hopefully illustrate how these ideas can be applied in other contexts as well. And my example is the British National Party and its response to Islamist extremism, to Islamist terrorism. So its response to a different kind of crisis, if you like, a crisis in national security. The BNP, the British National Party, is often seen, not without some reason, as the direct descendant and heir of 20th century fascism. You know, you often hear it described as a neo-fascist party. It was formed in 1982 as part of the endless process of splits and breakaways which characterise all extremist organisations, and I think psychologically that's an interesting phenomenon in itself, but not one I've got time to go into now. Its first leader was somebody called John Tyndall, whose prior history had been in explicitly neo-Nazi organisations. The fascist movements, actually, and the Nazi and fascist movements of the 20th century were the subject of some classical work in political psychology, not the kind of neuroscientific political psychology that Mix is talking about, but earlier psychoanalytically influenced political psychology, the main focus of which actually was, as you may know, fascism. So we do have some quite old, but I think still quite rich analyses of the emotional dynamics of fascism. For example, in the various theorizations of the authoritarian personality. And I think that those theories from the 1930s, 40s, 50s are probably some of the earliest kind of thermal images that that we have of the emotions underlying a political movement. Now, that work has got lots of shortcomings. It's been subject to a lot of criticism. There are many important critiques of it. But in my view, it does offer some psychologically quite compelling accounts of mid-20th century fascism. And it suggests that we can see the origins of the authoritarian personality in a certain pattern of childhood experience, which led to a very intense and conflicted relationship with authority. Now, some of you may be familiar with this, but for those who are not, here's a bit of a rather sort of heavy dose of psychoanalytic political psychology. The individual, who's typically male in this picture, had been the child of overbearing and emotionally distant parents, and developed a powerful rage against the parents for their emotionally depriving and punitive regime. However, that rage was not expressed towards the parents, towards its, if you like, true objects. Instead, both out of fear and also in the helpless love of a child for its parents, the child identified with the oppressiveness which he had suffered and managed his rage by becoming, in a crude sense, an intensified version of his father, ready as an adult to direct his anger towards an outgroup. The phrase that describes this mechanism, or one phrase, is identification with the aggressor. That was the way that the authoritarian personality was seen to develop, by not fighting against, but actually identifying with the repressive and punitive parenting that had been experienced. Then in adulthood, the authoritarian or fascist state becomes merged in this person's unconscious mind with a sort of an idealized image of the father, embodying his cruel authority, and the son identifies with the repressive and cruel aims of that state. Well, that picture, albeit very condensed and oversimplified, of what makes a fascist tick, whatever its shortcomings, it might still seem to be still applicable and to make sense of why the so-called neo-fascist directs xenophobic hatred towards ethnic or cultural outgroups. Indeed, the most striking continuity at the ideological level between British fascists of the 1930s and the BNP today is the antipathy towards an ethnic other, although the focus of that, of course, has shifted from the anti-Semitic focus of the mid-20th century to an anti-Islamic focus today. But the demands made by both the fascist and the BNP for the state to create a kind of purified nation purged of alien elements, that demand seems to be quite similar from 1930 to today. So today's so-called neo-fascism could be seen as based psychologically on the authoritarian personality, because it deploys a mindset organized around a fantasy image of an out-group as a repository of evil. However, I say it could be, but actually I don't think it can. Because I think if we try to apply the theory of the authoritarian personality to the actual behaviour of the contemporary BNP, and I suspect to many contemporary far-right groups in other countries, we'd find that it actually doesn't fit very well. In the case of the BNP's response to Islamist terrorism, we would predict, following the theory of the authoritarian personality, that the BNP would be demanding an ever stronger state to contend with this threat. It would be demanding upgrades of the state security apparatus, and it would be intensifying its focus of hatred towards Islam. But that's not actually what we find. Two social psychologists at the University of Surrey recently studied some articles that had appeared on the BNP website in the wake of the 7/7 bombings in London. And you might think that those bombings were a golden opportunity for all of the extreme organisations of the far right to build their profiles and to garner some public support. In their study of the material on the BNP website in the months following the 7/7 attacks, this was mainly articles by the leader Nick Griffin and by one other leading member of the BNP. Two major discursive themes were found. The first, not surprisingly, was a condemnation of Islam as a fundamental and fundamentalist threat to Britain, with the 7/7 bombings described as genocidal race attacks by Islamic fascists. And actually, the choice of word there, choice of the term fascist by the BNP to describe Islamist terrorists is an interesting one. Again, I haven't got time to go into that, but I think that's psychologically it's quite an interesting choice of term. That was one theme, the one you'd expect. The second theme was a condemnation of multiculturalism as the cause of Islamic terrorism in the UK. And maybe, in a way, the BNP was a little bit ahead of some of the things that have, some of the debates that have happened since 2005. Across Europe about the nature and the fate of multiculturalism in those European countries. Anyway, according to the BNP, the multicultural nightmare of Britain, is the phrase they use, it creates large immigrant populations from whose ranks terrorists emerge, and because it has anti-white and pro-diversity policies which have allowed a, quote, fascist death cult, again the choice of the term fascist, to grow unchecked. Because the law in this country bows down to ethnics and immigrants as if they were lords of this land, then would-be terrorists are emboldened to attack and are free to pursue their preparations for attack, and may even be supported by the liberal state as they prepare to attack. So this immediate post-7/7 material from the BNP lays the blame for the disaster of the attacks pretty fully, on the politicians in general who created it, and in particular on the Blair government. Of course, any others who support multicultural or liberal values are also objects of contempt. Liberalism as a whole is seen as serious an enemy as Islamism and terrorism. In more recent outputs from the BNP, if you scan their website and the opinions on it over the last year or two, you will also see a similar pattern of discursive focus on the politicians responsible for the Islamist threat. The principal rage, in fact, is felt towards the political establishment for its role in creating that threat. Nick Griffin warns that urban rivers all over Western Europe will flow with much blood, an echo there of an earlier far-right British politician, Enoch Powell, from the 1960s. And Griffin sees the cause of this impending catastrophe in the crowning folly all the evil works of those who set out to deconstruct and destroy Western civilization. And he's not talking about the Islamists though, he's talking about our own politicians. The crowning folly being the deliberate breaching of the old dividing lines between the West and Islam, which again, it's the governing classes in the UK who are held primarily responsible for that. They're seen as traitors. Westminster traitors is a common phrase. And their treachery is threefold. Firstly, welcoming immigrants into the country. Secondly, giving them VIP treatment. And thirdly, pursuing a foreign policy which is also seen as a significant cause of the terrorist attacks. That is the foreign policy of as evidenced in Iraq and Afghanistan. And the BNP joins in the particular pursuit of Tony Blair, saying that he's directly responsible for the deaths of over 1 million Iraqis and Afghanis and should be tried for crimes against humanity and hung. There's also an interesting passage which I'll have to miss out about the possibility of an attack on Iran. The BNP is very hot on the idea that the British ruling class is about to lay into Iran. What emerges as well from this material is not only the attack on the ruling establishment, but the fact that the terrorist threat gets subsumed into an older fear, which is not about terrorist attack, but it's about Islamification. It's the old appeal of the far right, which is to the quality of everyday life, life on the street, and the Islamification of British culture, as feared by the BNP and by those to whom it is trying to appeal. But the main theme, my main point now, is that the focus of the rage is not on the Islamists themselves, but on the ruling class. Sorry, Ryan, how long shall I? Can I just take a couple more minutes to wind up? To draw a central conclusion from this, really. Hatred of the other is still a key component of this state of mind, obviously. It's global jihad now, not the international Jewish conspiracy, but hatred of the other is still key to the whole state of mind. But the point I'm making is that the focus, the active focus of the rhetoric and of the rage contained in the rhetoric is of those who are the present national authorities. And I think that shows how the politics of the far right have changed since the days of classical fascism, which was actually about preserving the status quo and to some extent defending the ruling classes against the rising communist threat and preserving the imperial glory of Britain. So the discourse in post-imperial Britain, the discourse of the far right, has got to be different. It can't be the same as it was 70 or 80 years ago. And I've been describing one era of difference, as seen in a conventional political camera, looking at the actual rhetoric and ideology of the BNP. If I can just now turn the thermal camera onto that rhetoric, then this is very unlike the classic authoritarian personality who raged against a harsh and repressive parent. The 21st century extreme ethno-nationalist, who I think we can't call neo-fascist, is raging against a corruptly permissive parent, raging directly against this parent, not having to displace or deflect the rage, raging directly against a corruptly permissive parent who is attacked for not exercising parental authority, for perversely favouring outsiders, and for abandoning those in the UK who are entitled to its protection. This is the kind of a thermal image, I think, of the BNP rhetoric I've been describing. And it's very different from the thermal imagery we get if we look at the psychology of classical fascism. And it also brings the BNP into a strange alignment with many on the left and liberal parts of the spectrum in its attack on British foreign policy in particular, and its attack on counter-terrorist surveillance. Another theme that I've not been able to cover is the BNP's attack on counter-terrorist surveillance, which again brings it into strange alignments. To conclude, the overall point I want to make is that in today's kind of postmodern political landscape, things are in much more flux, both politically. We know that we don't have stable ideological blocks any longer. Our political parties are no longer the stable forms they were. Similarly, in the emotional public sphere, I think there is a growing instability in terms of emotional configurations and the connections between particular patterns of emotional feeling and particular political positions. And I think what this means, and this really will be my final observation, is that I think the BNP of the future, if the BNP has a future, maybe a bit more like what I understand the Laos in Greece is, a much more kind of much more colourful, multicoloured beast, much more flexible and agile political animal, maybe with able to appeal politically and emotionally to broader and more diverse constituencies, rather than be, as some people I think mistakenly take the BNP to be, some kind of recrudescence of classical fascism, which it clearly isn't. There's obviously a lot more to be said about that, but my time is more than up. Sorry to have run over.
Thank you.